In the autumn of 1609, Galileo Galilei, a 45-year-old professor of mathematics at the University of Padua, directed a 20-powered telescope at the moon, setting off a chain of events that was to shake the intellectual edifice of Europe to its foundations. Although by no means the first scientist to use the new device in this way, Galileo was by far the most successful. He made the first crucial discoveries with the instrument and dominated this new area of inquiry as no one has since. That's according to Albert von Helden in the introduction to his translation of Galileo's treatise Sidereus Nuntio. The common wisdom at the time was that heavenly bodies tended to be perfectly smooth. But when Galileo examined the moon with his 20-powered spyglass, its surface appeared anything but smooth. It seemed rough and uneven. The dividing line between light and dark was not a smoothly curved line at all, as one would expect if the moon's surface was perfectly smooth. Instead, it was very irregular. In the bright parts, features were starkly outlined by black lines that grew broader and narrower as the light of the sun varied. In the dark part, there were little patches of light. Galileo drew the conclusion that the moon's surface is full of mountains, valleys, and plains, just as the Earth's surface is. In a letter dated January 7, 1610, the first letter describing telescopic observations, he put it this way: "It is seen that the moon is most evidently not at all of an even, smooth, and regular surface, as a great many people believe of it and of the other heavenly bodies, but on the contrary, it is rough and unequal. In short, it is shown to be such that sane reasoning cannot conclude otherwise than that it is full of prominences and cavities similar, but much larger, to the mountains and valleys spread over the Earth's surface." Galileo went on to describe the phenomena in considerable detail, rehearsing, as it were, the observations and conclusions he was to publish more elaborately a few months later in his treatise. He also mentioned that he was about to finish an instrument that would enlarge things 30 times, adding, "Of all the above observations, none is seen or can be seen without an exquisite instrument, because of which we can believe to have been the first in the world to discover something about the heavenly bodies from so nearby and so distinctly." He was thus fully aware by this time of the historical importance of what he was observing. What he did not know yet on January 7th was that another observation he mentioned would catapult him to fame in the next 3 months. "As besides the observation of the moon, I have observed the following in the other stars. First, that many fixed stars are seen with the spyglass that are not discerned without it. And only this evening I have seen Jupiter accompanied by 3 fixed stars, totally invisible because of their smallness, and the configuration was in this form." As mentioned above, others had already noticed that with a spyglass one can see many more stars than with the naked eye, but Galileo here drew the configuration of what he thought were 3 fixed stars near the planet Jupiter. His attention had been drawn to them by the fact that they formed a straight line with Jupiter, and when Galileo again sought out Jupiter the next evening, he expected to see the stars in the same formation. What he saw, in fact, was that Jupiter had moved to the east, still on the same straight line. This puzzled him, and he thought that perhaps the astronomical tables were wrong, and Jupiter had returned to its direct west-to-east motion. Jupiter's seemingly anomalous behavior greatly intrigued him. On the 9th of January, it was cloudy, but on the 10th, he could again observe the planet. To his surprise, he now saw only 2 of the stars, and Jupiter was to the west of both of them. Obviously, the planet's motion was retrograde after all, but how could the appearances change in this manner? Over the next week of observations, he found that there were in fact 4 little stars, that Jupiter was not moving away from them, but remained always on the straight line near them, and that the stars moved along the straight line with respect to each other and Jupiter. By January 15th, at the latest, he had the solution to this strange behavior. Jupiter had four moons. Aha! Aha! A real Eureka moment! The novelty and importance of this discovery can hardly be overstated. Since time immemorial, there had been only seven wanderers, the Moon and Sun, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Now, all of a sudden, one of them was shown to have four companions. Wanderers completely unknown to the great philosophers of antiquity, and they answered a major criticism against the Copernican system. If the Earth were a planet, why should it be the only one to have a moon going around it? And how could there be two centers of motion in the universe? Now it was evident that the Earth was not the only planet to have a moon. Four hundred eight years later, composer Amanda Lee Falkenberg discovered 10 planetary moons, and as she tells us, she had her own aha moment, a true epiphany. She didn't run through the streets shouting Eureka like Archimedes, though she might have been as excited as he was. She tells us, and Matt Kaplan, "The plain and simple truth is that my project started so organically and so simply. I trace it back to 2017, and I was almost finished writing my 10-minute piano concerto called Crossing of the Crescent Moon, and I was about 8 minutes of my way into it, and I thought, you know what, I'm just going to research the ancient symbolism of crescent moons. And about 2 hours into my research, I stumbled across this website that said, 10 of the weirdest moons of our solar system. And I felt like a bolt of lightning just went through my system. I had so much excitement seeing this collection of moons. I was on my iPad. I was just staring at them. And the first feeling that came to me was that these moons need music. Being a film composer, I'm well aware of what happens when you team up music with stories. It just elevates it to a whole new level. And so, I'm here, looking at these moons, going, oh my goodness, they're just locked in this vacuum of space. And I kind of just wanted to break them free from this. And I thought, wow, if I teamed them up with music, that might help amplify their stories. Even more so other people could enjoy them. That from an interview with composer Amanda Lee Falkenberg, recorded by Matt Kaplan of Planetary Radio for the Planetary Society. Now, we can stop and ask the question, what if Amanda hadn't been curious? What if she hadn't followed her desire to learn more? Think of Alice in Wonderland. What a wondrous wonderland she did discover. Amanda wouldn't have been sitting here at the WVIA studios preparing to speak with passion about the journey of exploration and creativity that brought her to northeastern Pennsylvania for the world premiere of her Moons Symphonic Suite this Friday with the Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic and assembled singers and even a NASA astronaut who is her friend. On this side of the story, Nicole Stott, the NASA astronaut who has become Amanda's friend, Nicole Stott is the hinge here. Should we use the word chance, or is it better to say serendipity or even synchronicity? Nicole Stott and Melise Brunet, music director and conductor of the Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic, happened to be seated next to each other on a flight to Scranton, perhaps 3 years ago. And they got to talking as people do on a plane flight when Nicole described the project she'd been working on with Amanda, who had just recorded her Moons Symphony with the London Symphony Orchestra under Maren Alsop. We might say, pun intended, Melise was over the moon. And instantly, she tells us, she ordered the recording and upon hearing the music, she was determined to bring Amanda's work to the region. Alice said, curiouser and curiouser. Well, these two artists are definitely creative and curious to the max, to our benefit. This Friday, May 1st, the Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic with the Marywood University Concert Choir will present the world premiere of the Moons Symphonic Suite, created from the larger Moons Symphony by the composer. All part of a concert titled Planets, Moons, and Star Wars. The concert will also feature The Planets by Gustav Holst and a suite of favorite themes from the original trilogy of Star Wars films. And to enhance the experience, there will be specially created multimedia projections. We had a visit from composer Amanda Lee Falkenberg, Dr. Rick Hoffenberg, director of the Marywood University Concert Choir, and Chasen Goldschmitz, executive director of the Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic, for a conversation about the music Amanda has composed to break the moons free and to tell their stories for our delight and wonderment. The fact that Melisse and Nicole wound up on a plane to Scranton, sitting next to each other, not knowing each other, striking up a conversation, and you're sitting in this chair because of that coincidence. It's quite something. But I think I've read that there might have been some coincidences in your coming to this subject. Meeting Nicole and getting to work with her in a way wasn't foreordained.
Well, I was just saying to Rick before, actually, so much of this project is based around serendipity. And it's funny because when Nicole and I interview about the Moon Symphony, which she's a huge champion for, you know, she gets told off for using the word awesome so much. And I get told off for using the word serendipitous so much. So I just can't not use that word. And I do think about that encounter between Nicole and Melisse. And I'm just like, there it is. You know, there it is showing up when, you know, we're not even the same locale. And it's just like this Moon Symphony has a life of its own and wants it to be out in any shape or form. And here she is interacting and having these awesome conversations. And then here's Chasen and, you know, making this happen. And so I'm so grateful for that that encounter.
I know you've told the story a million times, but the direction you took with this piece drew you into a scientific world. Is that a world that was new to you at that time?
That was very interesting to encounter that, because that didn't actually start. That didn't come with the initial inspiration. What actually started was seeing these weird moons of our outer solar system and seeing them together collectively. And I'm just, the first thing that came to me was, oh my goodness, these moons need music. And then the next kind of weird thing that came to my mind was, these moons need emotion. And so I literally just was just so committed to putting their worlds into a sound world. And I started sort of investigating the characteristics and terrain. And as I was discovering and researching as much as I could about them, I started realizing there's a lot of science attached to their worlds. And at that point, I wasn't planning on putting a choir with this idea, this initial symphony. And I thought, I felt like this science was just tapping me on the shoulder saying, hey, can we come for this ride as well? And I'm like, well, you know, if I employed a choir, that would give it more outreach and give it more credibility, the science. And so I did. I decided, well, all right, I'll just incorporate a choir. But that's really how the science piece came into being.
And what about Pythagoras? Did that ever come with a music of the spheres? Was that ever mentioned by anybody?
Not really. I think I was just so drawn to the space missions and the legacies of NASA's legendary, you know, Voyager and Cassini and Galileo spacecrafts. And there was just a lot of data that I wanted to just sort of roll around in terms of just really trying to figure out how to amplify these incredible space missions and all the work that these scientists are doing. Like, here's an opportunity to use a different environment, a different structure, such as a symphony orchestra, to help promote their work. It hasn't been done. In fact, when I stumbled across the moons as a symphony, I started Googling, and because I thought, surely someone else has thought about this, and they hadn't. So I just jumped on the idea and thought, okay, I'm really going to see how far I can take this.
And aren't the names of the moons so poetic and so lovely, aren't they?
They are very, their melody in itself, as you probably have already recognized. I think Ganymede's my favorite. Like, I love saying that. In fact, at one point I was thinking of writing a Ganymede piano concerto or something. But they are, they're based mainly in Greek mythology, which is very poetic in itself. But, you know, these worlds and what they're finding, one thing I love to say about this symphony is, you know, like John Williams, the sci-fi of the space world, this is sci-fact. Like this is why I wanted to connect with NASA scientists to make sure it's anchored in scientific accuracy. And that's what I'm really excited to have, sci-fact space adventures to the outer solar system. So it's my version of, you know, trying to capture the spirit of a John Williams legacy in Star Wars. But here we are using real live scenes and events taking place in our outer solar system right now. It's just so compelling, at least to me.
Rick, we have just heard Amanda say there are little moons and such talking into her ear and talking about maybe words and maybe the choir and that kind of thing. What is your experience with this music now, and can you imagine it without a choir?
Well, I say with complete bias, I think the choral writing adds a tremendous amount to the symphony, and I'm not sure I can think of the music without, although I will say the Complete Moon Symphony has some extraordinary writing for the orchestra alone. And one of the things I was saying to Amanda earlier that I so appreciate about her writing is that it's actually very rare for a composer to be equally a master at using orchestral instruments to create colors and also be so adept at writing for the voice. People, I think, are under the impression that writing for the voice is fairly straightforward. We all have this instrument inside of us. We can all sing. You know, all you have to do is tell a composer, well, if you're writing for a certain voice part, a soprano, mezzo soprano, tenor, these are roughly the top and bottom notes, and okay, you're off and running. But more often than not, you know, Erica, something you know is that I spend my summers on the music staff at Chautauqua Opera, and I have the great pleasure of working with young composers there as part of their Composers in Residence program. And I encounter very talented young composers who nonetheless struggle writing for the voice because they don't understand concepts like tessitura. For listeners who may not know that word, it's not just about the range of a piece of music, but it's about where does most of it lie. And music can be very fatiguing to sing if the composer is not really skilled and aware of the tessitura, where the bulk of the music lies, because of the way the vocal instrument works. Any vowel, any consonant, the way words are articulated, the way singers breathe, the way phrasing works, it makes it so gratifying to sing music by a composer who understands and is a master of all these different aspects of writing for the voice. And, you know, of course, the inspiration in the rhythm and the melody and the harmony and everything that goes into the writing, the inspiration comes from the text. But it's not just the meaning of the words and what's behind the astronomical inspiration. It's also the actual sounds of the words. And clearly, Amanda is so aware of what these words sound like. And I will tell you, this may make you laugh, it has inspired these geeky debates among us about some of the pronunciations. For example, I have two English professors who are in the choir, and so we've gotten into a debate as to whether it's nebule or nebule. And I go online and I see one thing. And so we may change some of that, you know, when Amanda comes and listens to the choir. But the point is that the choristers have become so invested in every detail of this piece. And that's really a sign of how much they admire it, respect it, and enjoy being a part of it.
How so? How is it that you can do what Rick suggests? Are you a singer? Did you spend time around singers? Is it that it has just come to you?
I wish I could say I was a singer. I'm not a singer. I sung in choirs during my high school years. I was an alto, hold my harmony. But I actually do not know. Like, I think if anything, it's just been so invested and curious about how I could just take my art to a level of excellence. Like, and I knew that, you know, especially when I started being involved with these NASA scientists, I mean, we're talking about excellence there, I just knew that every aspect of this project had to just be just draped in as much brilliance as possible. And so I was just telling Rick before, during the COVID era, before Marin Alsop's orchestra did the first read through ever in Vienna, I flew to be with her and just read through all the parts. But prior to that, I hired a whole bunch of instrumentalists in London through Zoom conversations, just play through the part. And I also hired voices from London Voices during COVID as well, just to sort of see if, you know, the parts were singable. So I really did a lot of back checking as much as possible to ensure that, you know, I'm sitting here having these incredible conversations with Rick and his feedback. You know, it's really very satisfying to hear this.
And the text, and we know how critical that is, and Rick, you just laid it out for us. What is the text and how did you craft it to make it singable?
That was probably one of my favorite parts of the creative process. How I work is I have an incubation period, which is I do the research. I do not step into my studio for several months. And then I announce to the household and cats and husband, it's time to put down the science books and get into the studio. And I literally put them to the side. And then I craft and I orchestrate. And I absolutely, of course, love that. And then what I will do once I'm decided that that movement is finished, movement, I will then take an MP3 of the orchestration and I'd go out into my sunroom with a cup of tea, put my headset in, get out my science books and listen to the patterns of the music and the melody and craft from there the rhythm with the science. And then I'm looking at the science going, well, you can't really put that word in. It's not really going to make sense. So I had to sort of like put a poetic lens on it to then sort of soften it for the theatre. And I just have to say that was such a fun part. I loved it, just sitting there with my pencils and paper, very old style. And that was a very joyful part of the process.
Tell us, Jason, how this project came here.
So I will pick up from the serendipity of Milis Brunet, our music director, meeting with astronaut Nicole Stott after having sat next to her on the plane to Scranton. We were looking as we were creating the whole arc of this particular season, and we were looking for a really great way to wrap it up, to have, you know, as we're approaching the 250th for America, you know, how can we really bring out an inspiring, powerful end to the season? And we do our best to partner with as many local artistic partners and other organizations as we can, including WVIA. And in this case, our partner around this happened to be the Everhart Museum. And the Everhart, we were talking about future plans, a number of different potential projects, and they had mentioned, well, you know, we're going to have this exhibit of NASA imagery from the Hubble Space Telescope. It's going, so we, you know, this was long before it had been announced and had actually come to Scranton, said, oh, we'll have it around this time. And so I was speaking with Melise and saying, you know, okay, well, there's this program. We could do something space related. And immediately she says, I want to do the moons. It was around that she said, I have this really great, this amazing program. I met this astronaut, told the whole story, said we can pair it with the planets. And that's what we did. And it's just, it's incredible to work with someone like Melise Brunet. And we are just so fortunate here in Northeastern Pennsylvania to have her at the helm of the Philharmonic. And to have her artistic vision and foresight and her creativity and her championing of contemporary composers and her championing of incredible multimedia experiences. So, and that's really what this concert is designed for, that it's science fiction, it's astronomy, it's astrology, it's big bombastic orchestral program. It's amazing choirs and it's incredible artistic multimedia design, both with the moons as well as with the planets, for which we have projection designer Camilla Tassi also coming to join us this week. And she has just some incredible, more artistic visuals that are associated with the planets. And so it's just to bring all of this together on, you know, a lovely Friday afternoon at the beginning of May. It's at the Philharmonic, our goal really is about not just concerts, but experiences. How can we create an experience where audience member goes into the hall, brings their family or engages with those around them, and leaves feeling awe, leaves feeling some aspect of just incredible emotion that you really can't get outside of a concert hall. So, and we're so pleased to have you with us this week, Amanda. We're so pleased to be working with you, Rick, again in your choir, and with Joshua Harper and the Choral Society of Northeastern Pennsylvania. And this is going to be just such an exciting program this week.
Now, the program also includes John Williams and Star Wars, and we sometimes see the word cinematic associated with your work that you have, in fact, composed for television and film. What is the experience that you've had with such forms? Does it inform this work at all in any way?
100%. It's one of my favorite questions, actually. Because when I stumbled across these moons and I started realizing I was taking on the role of producer and director and casting calling, you know, I had to sort of audition these moons to see who's going to get the gig. And I felt like, you know, I was sort of like the George Lucas, like at least in my imagination, you know, John Williams, George Lucas. And yet the nice thing was I didn't have to deal with sound design, you know, the sabers and et cetera. So I really enjoyed just being at the helm of all of that, of all those decisions. And so I drew very much on my film composing days, which is, you know, when I'd get a script for a film or I'd have to read a book to inform myself on the, you know, the emotional landscape, I would just digest as marinate in that as much as I could. And then before I then go and set forth to encase those emotions in a sound world. And that's exactly the same process that I applied for these Seven Moons. And yeah, it was just, yeah, just, I felt so blessed. I felt to have the idea and just really wanted to make sure that it was just as cinematic and experiential as possible and a feast of the senses, you know, where you just, everything is immersed. And a lot of the time, Nicole says that about space flight, it's just all your senses are engaged. And she often mentions that when she's experiencing the Moon Symphony, which is why she's such a huge champion for this. And so we're so grateful to be here in Scranton and to have this opportunity for this world premiere of the Choral Suite.
Now, tell us, Rick, what you have done, because you have done Brahms and all kinds of things with your choir and Fauré. How do you approach something that nobody's ever heard, and what do you do to introduce them to the excitement, of course, of creating something fresh? But you said about diction and all that kind of thing. But what about just, okay, this is it?
Well, thank you. I mean, in a way, the early stages of preparation are very similar, whether we're working on a world premiere or a piece that has been around for 200 or 300 years. You try as much as possible to get inside the head of the composer and glean what you can from the score. So I look and see what's on the page. If there's a history of recordings, I include that as well, because the legacy of recorded music is very important. And then I try to prepare the chorus in a way that balances technical considerations, cleanliness of intonation, accuracy of rhythm, balance, blend, all the things that you want when you're preparing for somebody else to give their own interpretation. But you also want, prior to Melisse coming and Amanda hearing the chorus, you want the chorus to have some sort of inspiration on their own. And that can be tweaked by the conductor and the composer, but you want to come with some point of view based on what you know of the music. So I want them to, tonight we in our rehearsal with the composer and conductor, I want the chorus to have the ability to give a very convincing rendition of the piece that can then be tweaked and molded appropriately. Part of choral preparation is to make sure that they're flexible so that you don't establish an interpretation that's set in stone, but rather you give them the tools to be able to adjust once they know ultimately how it's going to be performed. But I want them to feel inspired. So I always want them to go beyond the technical and pragmatic aspects of what's on the page and really try to the extent possible to develop an understanding of what they're singing. I did share with Amanda, in all honesty, I wish we had had more time to discuss the moons and how are these moons different and what is the scientific information we should have at our disposal that will help inform the way she wrote this piece. And, you know, there's never enough time in rehearsal. And that's one of the things I wish we had spent more time on. But we are so lucky and privileged to have her presence here, and she can, of course, share some of that with us, and it will only heighten the excitement that the members of the chorus are already feeling.
Music to your ears to hear that.
Very good. Yeah, it really is. And, you know, we talk about experience. Chasen was using that word, and I was saying to Rick earlier, you know, one thing that I really have been so invested in with every aspect of this creative process is making sure that everyone has such a positive and uplifting experience. You know, my sister has this great saying, go and inspire the daylights out of everyone, Amanda. And, you know, that's all we ever want to do as artists is, you know, you can never be sure that your music is going to resonate. You hope it will. And so, you know, it's all about, and so when I'm hearing this feedback from Rick, and yeah, it really is so powerful. And so, you know, you just look back on the whatever 7-8 years this project's been in the making, and to now at this point of its evolution to hear this feedback is just so awesome. And I can't wait to meet the choral forces tonight and, yeah, and share some backstories with them.
What about projections now? Is that something that complements the piece? We know it could stand on its own. How do you view projections?
Well, I agree. I think it could be a standalone with or without visuals. I've had a lot of people say to me when they were listening to my music, they'd close their eyes when I give them the mood board with the actual visuals. So I think it's kind of maybe on personal taste a little bit, but I think it's good to have it there as an option, because some of these images coming from NASA are just impeccable, like the Cassini missions, what's coming from Titan. And then I've worked with incredible space artists where they give their artistic representation. I think that's nice. I've sort of give a blend of that as well as the actual imagery. And it's noted on the projection as well, so you know if it's something inspired by an imagination. But the nice thing about the artists that I've used, they are very much informed by science, and which is how I got to know this organization to begin with. So every aspect of this moon symphony is just everything's anchored in scientific accuracy. So that's been a really excellent part of the collaborative spirit of this team.
Aside from the name Ganymede, what inspires you, intrigues you, excites you about Ganymede as a moon?
Well, it's the biggest moon in our solar system. It has its own magnetic field. And also it helps pivot us back to planet Earth, because I've divided that, and it was quite a tricky artistic decision to make at the time. But when I decided I was going to do it, I felt really good about it, because all the other moons are very science driven. And when I got to Ganymede, I saw obviously the Galileo connection back in 1610, his discovery of Jupiter and its moons. And so I thought, gosh, here's a really good opportunity from a historical perspective to talk about Galileo Galilei. And so the second half of Ganymede's actually divided into a historical sort of homage to the father of modern science. And not only that, I did like the idea that just gives a whiff of a human element, because it's preparing us to go back to Earth's moon and just to sort of look at the legacy of the awesome Earthlings of our planet and sort of just kind of threads that idea sort of gently in the minds of the audiences, because we're about to go back to our home planet and look at that from a very different perspective. So that's kind of, Ganymede is an interesting moon from that perspective.
And it wasn't always that way. We weren't always going to have the Earth rise. It was something to do with an encounter you had with Nicole, perhaps?
Actually, it was Miranda. Miranda, I always get asked, what's your favourite moon? And I don't like to answer that most of the time, but actually, in truth, I do have a favourite moon. And it is Miranda, only because initially when I started this symphony, there was only 6 moons that I had shortlisted. And I remember, I think Miranda was the 4th moon I'd started composing for. And I had done my research, and I was in the process of writing her music and orchestrating her world, which is, you know, being burnt and bruised and battered, and it's just a very unusual terrain. She's been through a lot, and it's probably the most dramatic out of all of the moons to sing and to play. And anyway, but here I was, just for a couple of weeks during the creative process, I'd say to my husband, something doesn't feel right about this project. Something doesn't feel right about this. I can't put my finger on it. And weeks went by, and as I was building up her sound world, I was just becoming so, so emotionally disturbed by what I was creating. And I remember at one point, I'm just like, oh my God, I just want to beam myself out of here and go somewhere safe. And before I knew it, I just looked kind of weird in my mind and sort of found myself back on planet Earth. And I looked up and I thought, oh my God, I know what's missing. It's our moon. This is what has not been feeling right. We need to tell the story of our planet, but from the perspective of Earth's moon. And so it's living in her world that I'm so grateful for, because she gave me a very important aspect to, you know, finishing this, the big arc, the big narrative of this story. And that's how Nicole came into it. So, yes.
Speaking of serendipity, you didn't know that Artemis 2 would be taking place.
That was, yes, that was entirely serendipitous.
And how did you, were you glued to watching the mission?
Well, not only that, but I'm very happy to say that at the kind of 11th hour, I'm writing to Chase and saying, hey, Chase, can I change the projection for the visuals for the seventh movement? Because we're actually going to be putting in some of the imagery from Artemis. And I was saying to Nicole, she's been helping me locate some of the most, you know, breathtaking imagery. So I've had to sort of redesign the seventh movement, only because we thought there's no way we're going to miss this opportunity. And, you know, I was saying to my husband, this may be one of the first performances that actually incorporate, you know, so intentionally these imagery. So it could be quite historic on so many other levels as well.
Did I read that the score is on the moon?
It is on the moon. And that, yes, it is a fun fact. It's Nicole's husband, Chris Stott, who managed to finesse that one. And it's just, you know, I think, yes, it does sound very, it is, it's very a cool concept. But I think, I mean, this is the way that I feel in terms of storytelling as an artist. I think for me, the most important part of that story is not so much, oh, your music's on the moon. What I connect with is the audience, because when they are sitting, listening to that seventh movement, I love the idea that if some of them even can just think this way in terms of, okay, that music that they're listening to right now, it's actually on the moon that we want them to be on right now. And so, you know, in some ways that connection to help really impact them into that story, that is what I'm so, you know, so invested in the most about that opportunity. So I like to be able to tell people that story, not because of the, oh, look, it's on the moon. It's like, but make that connection with yourself when you are experiencing that seventh movement.
Have you recently heard the Planets in performance?
Yes, in Chicago. So we, a couple of years ago, 2024, the Chicago Symphony premiered this Moon Symphonic Suite. And that's, you know, an adaptation of the Moon Symphony. And they also paired it with Planets as well. I think, so Planets was first and then it was Moons. And we had the projections for the Moons for that, which was really quite impactful. So yes, I have, and I do love Planets. And I often get asked about, you know, Holston. And I often say, you know, if Holst was living in this day and age, I bet he would maybe have, you know, used science of those worlds to help inform his creative decisions. So, you know, there's just some really lovely sort of parallels that I like to draw with his work and my work. We spent the same amount of time creating it. His was a passion project. Mine was a passion project. So, yeah, I just feel like, and I think that is my favorite, just knowing how inspired he was about Planets and how devoted I was to encasing these incredible worlds into a symphonic canvas as well. And I think that's where I really love to draw the connection with Holst.
Just one more question about your collaborators at NASA. There is a website with thumbnail photos and a little bit about what they each had to say. So it was just casual sitting down and having conversations over tea or email or Zoom different with each of the collaborators?
Well, when I started researching, well, I started with Europa first, actually, and I, being a teacher, being an educator, I like to know that things are rock solid in terms of accuracy. And I kept stumbling across a lot of inconsistencies with my online research. And I'm like, oh, and I said to my husband, I need to consult with a moon specialist. And I didn't know they were called planetary scientists back then. And so he was out one morning having a cup of coffee out looking at the roses and stuff. And I'm on my computer. I'm like, I need to find out who this person is and who I'd been watching on YouTube. And you know, I called him this character because he'd be rugged up in like Eskimo gear and talking about this moon Europa that's, you know, ocean world hidden under 20 kilometers of ice. And so it was absolutely fascinating. So, of course, that was going to get the gig for the symphony. So I found out this gentleman's name and I said to my husband, I'm like, oh, he's from NASA. And I'm just going to email him. I'm going to tell him about my project. Now, by this point, I had not even written any music. And so I found his email, but it's one of these black hole emails where you're never sure they're going to reach, it's going to reach them. So I'm just sitting out in the garden just saying, oh, I just said to Paul, I'm going to write to him. I'm going to see if he could help me sort of figure out some of this science. So I just literally wrote to him and not thinking anything of it, just sort of shared my vision with him and asked if he would be up for a consultation on Skype or something. And 7 days later, I got an email saying, Amanda, your project sounds really interesting and I'd be happy to speak with you. And so we did. About a month later, we had this Zoom conversation. It was absolutely riveting. And at some point in the conversation, he said to me, Amanda, you know, I think the scientists would be really interested in what you're doing. I said, really? And he said, oh, yes, they would. And then he happened to be very good friends with Linda Spielke, who was the Cassini lead scientist for the Cassini mission. And so he told her about my project. And I'd just done a TEDx youth talk about the moons. And he shared that TED talk with her, and then she gave me the invitation to come to NASA JPL and present to the Cassini scientists at their Project Science meeting. And so that's the Von Karman Auditorium. And when I was there, I got to meet a whole bunch of scientists, so I could literally pick and choose who could I pivot to for the next moon. It was awesome. So it's kind of just snowballed since then, but that's really how the science and the NASA connection came about.
Just one more about the version that we'll hear. Take us through what came first and then what Chicago played and what we're going to hear, because it's very exciting that it hasn't been performed like this.
Exactly. So a lot of people don't realize that for the actual premiere recording in London with LSO, London Symphony Orchestra, and Maren Alsop conducting London Voices, they were recorded separately. It was COVID at the time anyway, but actually you do get a better production when you can separate the two. And so, yeah, a chorus had click track to LSO at Abbey Road Studios, but they have never been in the same room together. And so when this opportunity came about with Chasen and Nipa, and, you know, we did talk about formats, and I already, after the Chicago gig, I felt my husband and I discussed this, and I'm like, you know, I really should try and do some sort of choral versions in this situation. So I'd already sort of thought that through, and then Chasen came through with these discussions. And so I'm like, I'm going to make this work. And because I really wanted to see choral forces and symphony orchestra take to the stage. And, you know, I just absolutely know that this is just the perfect place for it to happen here in Scranton, just this team of people. And I can't wait to meet the conductor tonight. I haven't actually met her. And so, yeah, so that is a world premiere of this particular format. And next year, I haven't actually told Chasen this yet, but we have a world premiere in the USA of the actual Full Moon Symphony.
Oh, that's incredible.
And it's with Reno Nevada Orchestra with Laura Jackson and at the helm and her choral forces. So, and I just emailed her and I said, am I allowed to say anything yet? Because I had to be a bit mum about it. She said, we'd be delighted. So I know that you're following the evolution of the project, and it literally it's almost to the year. It's April 24th next year. So it is, big sigh there. So I'm so grateful for how this sort of hopscotched its way to that event. And I'm just super proud to be here and what we can bring to this community. Moons and Nicole coming soon and joining forces with this terrific team of musicians, conductors, and yeah, just super, super grateful.
Chasen, do you want to give us the particulars, please?
Absolutely, Erica. So the concert performance of Planets, Moons, and Star Wars with your Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic is this Friday, May 1st at 7 p.m. at the Scranton Cultural Center. You can get tickets at nepaphil.org or by calling 570-270-4444. We have your Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic. We have the two incredible choirs, Marywood University Concert Choir and Choral Society of Northeastern Pennsylvania. Stunning projections. We have Holst the Planets, Amanda Lee Falkenberg's The Moon's Choral Suite, and a suite of Star Wars tunes as well. So please do join us. This is fun for the whole family. And we do have two other smaller events this week as well. Thursday, April 30th, so this Thursday at 5:30 p.m., join us at the Everhart Museum for a panel discussion. Amanda will be there. We will have Nicole Stott, the NASA astronaut, there as well. Camilla Tassi, the projection designer for the planets, will be there, as will James Lansing, the Everhart Museum's curator. And we're going to be talking about this Friday's program. We're going to be talking about the moons, the planets. going to be talking about space. We're going to be talking about the Everhart's incredible imagery, NASA imagery that they have in their current exhibit. Definitely check out that exhibit if you haven't already, or you can check it out on Thursday. They'll have extended hours till 7 o'clock. And then we have one more event on Saturday, May 2nd, this Saturday at 10 a.m. at the Lackawanna County Children's Library. This is a free event, and we have astronaut Nicole Stott joining us for our Once Upon an Orchestra program. So it's story time paired with live music. And it will be astrophysicist Brian Greene's picture book and story, Icarus at the Edge of Time. And this is taking the Greek myth of Icarus, but bringing him to traveling to the edge of a black hole. And we got special permission from Philip Glass's publisher to be able to utilize an arrangement of what is an orchestral score to that picture book and have excerpts of that for that performance. That's a free event on Saturday morning. And also join us for the concert on Friday. We will be announcing the 26-27 season for your Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic. So we are so excited. We have so much in store that we're so excited to bring to this region. So definitely join us Friday, May 1st, 7 p.m., Scranton Cultural Center, Planets, Moons, and Star Wars. Get your tickets at nepaphil.org.
We heard from Chasen Goldschmitz, Executive Director of the Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic. We had the privilege of speaking with composer Amanda Lee Falkenberg and Dr. Rick Hoffenberg, who is director of the Marywood University Concert Choir, all in connection with the program Planet, Moons, and Star Wars that will take place this Friday, May 1st at 7 p.m. at the Scranton Cultural Center, featuring choirs, multimedia projections, NASA astronaut Nicole Stott, and the orchestra will perform The Planets by Gustav Holst, music from Star Wars, featuring themes from the original trilogy of Star Wars films, and the world premiere of composer Amanda Lee Falkenberg's The Moon's Choral Suite. The Marywood University Concert Choir, under the direction of our guest today, Dr. Rick Hoffenberg, will perform for the Moon's Suite. And then it will be the Choral Society of Northeast PA, under the direction of Dr. Joshua Harper, joining the Philharmonic for the Planets. All of this music will be under the direction of Mélisse Brunet, and she is the music director and conductor of the Philharmonic. For more information, on the web, nepaphil.org, nepaphil.org. And there you can learn about the Thursday evening presentation at the Everhart Museum in Scranton at 5:30, featuring a panel discussion, and it will include a chance to see the exhibition up through July 2026 of NASA imagery, Hubble Space Telescope, New Views of the Universe. And then the day after the concert, on Saturday, May 2nd at 10 a.m. at the Lackawanna County Children's Library, the Philharmonic will present a free event as part of their Once Upon an Orchestra series geared to young ones. And it's for anyone. In fact, in this case, NASA astronaut Nicole Stott will narrate the lovely children's book Icarus at the Edge of Time by astrophysicist Brian Greene, an imaginative sci-fi story about a child journeying to the edge of a black hole. And that will be accompanied by a trio of Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic musicians performing the music of Philip Glass, nepaphil.org. The concert is this Friday evening at 7 at the Scranton Cultural Center, and it will be Planets, Moons, and Star Wars, the world premiere of this piece, The Moon's Choral Suite by Amanda Lee Falkenberg.